few weeks ago in this room, we heard Dr. Kiri Baker give a very remarkable and startling lecture in which he stated his belief that we're now actually in the process of being infiltrated as a prelude to a complete takeover by some form of alien life. Now, some time ago, I also came to this conclusion as a result of a close study of certain reported incidents in the past, which I suspect to have been unsuccessful attempts at infiltration by certain semi-human creatures of alien origin. Now, I shall not have time to give many examples of these attempts, but I shall examine one in some detail, the case of the strange boy Caspar Hauser, where I think the evidence for an attempted infiltration is very strong. Now, these attempts, a sinister aspect of these attempts, which I think of as attempts at infiltration, is that the type of creature sent to Earth to make them seems to have approached more and more nearly the ordinary human pattern as time went on. The last attempt we can suspect, which was the attempt I'm going to tell you about Caspar Hauser, and of course we need to know those attempts which ended in failure. The ones which were successful, of course, we simply can't know about. So this attempt of Caspar Hauser in 1828, I think it's a very important one because it's really the most evolved attempt which we know of. Since his time, any creatures of unearthly origin sent to penetrate human society have probably been successful. At least there'll be no accounts I can find of any unsuccessful attempts. But the most significant aspect of Dr. Kiri Baker's lecture was, I found, the general atmosphere of sympathy with his conclusions on the part of the audience. The fact that many of us have already at least considered the possibility of alien infiltration indicates, I think, an entirely new attitude of thought, and is one of the signs of certain great changes which we must now expect. Now, in 1959, Professor Jung gave a very clear warning about these coming changes on the subject of UFOs, flying saucers, the mysterious things seen in the sky. He said as follows. He said, "These rumors, or the possible physical existence of such objects, seem to me so significant that I feel myself compelled, as once before, when events were brewing a fateful consequence for Europe, to sound a note of warning. I know that just as before, my voice is much too weak to reach the ear of the multitude. It is not presumption that drives me, but my conscience as a psychiatrist that bids me to fulfill my duty and prepare those few who will hear me for coming events which are in accord with the end of an era." As we know from ancient Egyptian history, there are symptoms of psychic changes that always appear at the end of one Platonic month and at the beginning of another. They are, it seems, changes in the constellation of psychic dominance of the archetypes, or gods as they used to be called, which bring about or accompany long-lasting transformations of the collective psyche. This transformation started within the historical tradition and left traces behind it, first in the transition from the age of Taurus to that of Aries, and then from Aries to Pisces, whose beginning coincides with the rise of Christianity. We are now nearing that great change which may be expected when the spring point enters Aquarius. It would be frivolous of me to conceal from the reader that reflections such as these are not only exceedingly unpopular, but come perilously close to those turbid fantasies which cloud the minds of world improvers and other interpreters of science and portents. But I must take this risk, even if it means putting my hard-won reputation for truthfulness, trustworthiness, and scientific judgment in jeopardy. I can assure my readers I do not do this with a light heart. I am, to be quite frank, concerned for all those who are caught unprepared by the events in question and disconcerted by their incomprehensible nature. Since, so far as I know, no one has yet felt moved to examine and set forth the possible psychic consequences of this foreseeable change, I deem it my duty to do what I can in this respect. I undertake this thankless task in the expectation that my chisel will make no impression on the hard stone it meets. But the context in which Jung gave this very remarkable warning, it appears in his book, I think maybe you've read, translated Flying Saucers, The Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. This context, I think, makes it clear what Jung had in mind when he wrote these words. He knew that some form of encounter or awareness of extraterrestrial life could not be long delayed. He also knew that such an event would cause the most violent upheavals among people here on Earth. Just as primitive people suddenly faced for the first time with European technology, often gives way to despair and becomes demoralized, gives up and ceases even to breed. So it's possible that in our present state of unpreparedness, we too might become utterly demoralized and our society might simply collapse if faced with a sudden manifestation of an extraterrestrial people of incomparably higher technology. Yet the extraordinary thing is that at the moment we are entirely unprepared for any event of this kind. The scientists, as you know, say that we are probably only one of countless other places in the universe suitable for the evolution of life. But our present way of thought renders us quite incapable of understanding anything of what this might mean. It's the only people who really take the UFO phenomenon seriously are the scientists like this one, which makes a special study of it, and the governments of the world powers, who, as you know, have departments to examine and analyze the evidence. And apart from us and the governments, no one really, our framework of our thought doesn't really permit the consciousness of this to penetrate to us. By the tradition in which we were brought up, in which we think, that of Western liberalism, is a highly evolved philosophy. The trouble is, it has evolved as far as it can go, and is incapable of its limitations of any further expansion. For instance, it's quite incapable of dealing with the question of extraterrestrial life. Now, when this question has to be faced, and the signs are that there may be little time left for us to prepare ourselves, when the question has to be faced of the existence of extraterrestrial life, these limitations and the boundaries of our thought may prove disastrous. So before a new order of thought can take over from our present way of thought, a new higher way of thinking can be established, it's possible we may have to undergo disaster and chaos and the breakup of all the social patterns which our civilization has gradually evolved. We can't yet know the nature of the event which will cause these changes. Jung's warning is in vague terms because he realized the impossibility of expressing in limited present-day words an idea quite unlike anything we've known before. This has never really been thought of before, and it's incapable, one can never can't really say what these changes will be, what will exactly cause them, or what form they will take, and we didn't know there wouldn't be changes. And if there's something so radically different than anything we've known before, that we can't really conceive it. And Jung, who wrote a great deal more than was published, I think he was more specific in some of his writing which hadn't been published, but I thought his warning, which has been really neglected, he could only write in these somewhat vague terms. But although we are apparently faced with a possibly disastrous change, there is one hopeful aspect. I believe that for those of us who can receive it, there is a work of influence whose aim is to prepare us for those changes to come. Now, this belief in the shape of things to come, the future zeitgeist, as it were, is in some way predictable. It was the basic belief behind all early civilizations. The science of astronomy and his practical sense of astrology, predicting the, interpreting the patterns of the universe, was a science to which primitive civilizations of our past civilizations devoted all their efforts, to the exclusion of almost everything else. This is particularly noticeable in the civilizations of Central America, but it's also apparent in the case of the prehistoric civilization in Britain, the civilization before the Druids, from whom the Druids inherited their astronomical knowledge, which was of very high order. As you, some of you may know, the Druid instruction was so highly thought of in Europe that rich and powerful people from the continent used to send their sons to England to be trained by the Druids. And this course of instruction took about 20 years. It took 20 years to learn all that the Druids had to teach of astronomy and the nature of the gods and fruit of life and that sort of thing. It was all oral tuition, had to be learnt in rhymes. But the people before the Druids devoted their entire efforts to establishing the patterns of the universe, which would enable them to predict changes. And for this purpose, they built the fantastic prehistoric computer, Stonehenge. And the fact that this belief in the possibility of some form of external direction in our affairs exists today, and in fact even seems to be increasing, although there's no tradition of it, there's no formal education in it, but still people are thinking along these lines. And this, I think, is an indication that our minds may be being influenced, might be being made more receptive to the influence from somewhere else. Now, another indication that we may be being prepared to see the new basis for our philosophy is, I think, the increasing interest that a large number of people are now showing in the use of psychedelic or conscious-expanding drugs. Now, the subject of our use is a controversial one, and not a great deal is known about it. But there's no doubt that in some way they have already altered the general atmosphere, and the way in which we think now, the atmosphere of intellectual debate, as it were, is in some way already changed, so that different questions are asked, and the possibility of a different approach to problems of all sorts is now more likely to be considered. And most significant of all the indications of approaching change is, however, the appearance of UFOs. Now, there seems to be something deliberately enigmatic about these objects. Although more and more are seen, we seem in a way to know less and less about them. There seems to be a lack of pattern in their behavior, which itself seems almost deliberate. The unpredictable way in which they behave seems to be part of a pattern, although no actual pattern can be detected. You see, we still have no really good photographs, no reliable contact claims, yet no one can doubt that UFOs are actually appearing in increasing numbers all over the world. They seem to be both a portent of changes to come and an actual part of those changes. At any rate, their appearance has already shocked many people, perhaps everybody, into some degree of mental activity towards the general idea of extraterrestrial life. And this idea that we may not be alone in the universe, we may even be, as American Rush thought said, property, a sphere of influence of some other form of life, this idea is now becoming less generally unacceptable. Now, I say I give an example of a case where past attempts at infiltration by an alien being might be suspected. And this, I said, is a case of Caspar Hauser in 1828. Caspar Hauser turned up suddenly, as is the case of several other people, several other creatures not unlike him, outside the gates of Nuremberg on some afternoon. And somebody saw this boy He was hardly able to walk. He appeared to be absolutely numbed and bewildered. He was blinded by the light. He could only stagger about. He didn't even know where he was or anything. And he was led into the town, taken to the police station, and examined. Now, the mystery of him was caused quite a sensation. People came to look at him and such, and they found some very odd things about him. He was unable to speak, he knew no words. He knew one or two words, but in general he couldn't communicate. He appeared never to have been in the world before. He was like an idiot, but not an idiot. He turned out he was a very clever boy in some ways. And when he was examined, some very odd things were found about him. His senses were, to a supernatural extent, developed. He had this remarkable eyesight. There was a controlled experiment done with him by scientists who undertook a study of him. And he could see things which, details and things which was absolutely invisible to anybody else. Also his sense of smell, sense of hearing, were developed to an amazing extent. And in other ways he had certain senses which other people don't have, which ordinary human beings don't have. He could tell when a magnet was in the room. He could tell which pole of a magnet was pointed towards him. He said the south pole of the magnet affects him differently to the north pole. And also he was sensitive to metals. He could tell by approaching near a metal covered by a cloth what kind of metal it was, whether it was gold or brass or whatever it was. And he was, as I say, for some time quite closely examined. Now, he was educated and taught to speak. And when he could speak, he told the most remarkable story of where he'd come from. He said all his life, he was about 17 when he appeared, before that, all his life, as far as you remember, he'd sat in one room, one little cell, about 6 foot by 4 foot, with two small windows blocked up, so he couldn't see outside, two little round windows. And in the cell, no light would come in, no light from outside, and no sounds from outside. But the cell was always lit evenly, to an even temperature, heated to an even temperature, and lit to an even degree. So there was never any changes. In fact, he sat there all his life, against the wall, wearing just a shirt and trousers. When he went to sleep, when he woke up, he found beside him food and drink, and sometimes his shirt was changed and his hair and nails were cut. But all his life he never conceived the possibility of there being anybody else in the world or being any other place outside this little cell in which he was kept. One day, just before his release, someone did come into his cell, a hand appeared over his shoulder, and put a writing pad on his knee and guided his hand in making certain signs on paper, including the words Caspar Hauser, which was taken later to be his name. Sometime after this, a man entered his cell. You can see him, because he couldn't really, for a long time he couldn't tell objects from another. He couldn't tell if something was an object rather than part of the general, as it were, general background. But someone came into his cell, picked him up and carried him out. Carried him down some steps and led him for some time, although he was in tremendous pain, he was unable to walk, he'd never walked before, and he was blind and such, and all the sensations and smells of the world were terrifying to him. He was led to the gates in Nuremberg, and the man then vanished, and this is how he was found. Now, a great sensation was caused by his arrival, and a lot of theories were put forward. The popular theory, because he appeared in the 19th century during a very romantic period, the popular theory he was some sort of missing heir. He'd been captured as a little boy and hidden in a dungeon or something like that. And well, he was the heir of some theory. And this really drew attention from a much more remarkable theory by von Feuerbach, who was the president of the Court of Appeal, a very notable man in Bavaria at the time. He wrote a book about him. And Feuerbach said, give you only two alternatives to think about this boy. That either he spent all his life in a hole in the ground, or he has come miraculously by some magic transportation from some other planet. Now, after Feuerbach said this, something rather remarkable happened, which you may not think remarkable in light of what we've heard in certain books dealing with our subject, and what Dr. Taylor Baker said a few weeks ago. Von Feuerbach, having written this, died rather suddenly and unexpectedly at his great work, although he was in the prime of life and in very good health. Now, he's not the only person, you see, who's died possibly for this sort of reason. There was an 18th century Scotch minister called Robert Kirk, minister of a church in the Highlands, who devoted his life to studying supernatural phenomena, extraterrestrial creatures, fairies and ghosts and the like, from Highlanders who had experience of them. And he came to some very odd conclusions about these creatures. He had one very good expression. He said, fairies made of congealed air, which is a very sort of expressive way of describing what creatures whose consistency we don't know are like, different to us. And he put it this way, made of congealed air. His death was a very remarkable one. He collapsed, according to one account, he collapsed and died inside a fairy ring on a fairy mound, a circular fairy place. And there's no real account of his burial, but the local tradition is, in fact, he was abducted. And local people always said that Kirk was taken away by the devil or something, because he knew too much about supernatural creatures. Now, Caspar Hauser, after some time, after about 18 months, he was living with a scientist who was investigating him. And the woman of the house left him alone. And he was a victim of a murderous attack. Somebody came in who he described as the man who he thought had led him to Nuremberg and stabbed him with a dagger, left him for dead. In fact, he wasn't stabbed in a vital place. Although he bled a lot, he recovered. And after that, he was very carefully watched, kept under very close surveillance. And a great deal was written about him, and a great deal of speculation was written about him. And he was taken up by an Englishman, Lord Stanhope, who had some sort of relationship with him. They used to go out dining and driving together, and Lord Stanhope very much turned his head and made him very conceited and very difficult to get on with. And then some years later, the sensation never quite died down. The finding of Nuremberg had always been an object of pilgrimage by people from all over Europe. But he was eventually killed. He was stabbed in the public gardens. And when he came back from the public gardens, he had a terrible wound in his chest. And he said it was the same man again who stabbed him before, and he died. Now, the account of where he'd been all his life before he appeared seems so remarkable and significant. Because, of course, in terms of the time in which he came, it's impossible. It's impossible to imagine in the early 19th century, before electricity, the existence of any such cell, evenly heated and evenly lit, no visible source. It's very difficult to think of a room with two little windows. It's difficult also to think of a room which no sound, even the sound of thunder, can penetrate. And of course, the only thing which really asks description is the cabin of or cell in some kind of space vehicle. I think it's possible, you see, that Caspar Hauser was sent as a child, as a baby, so he knew anything where he came from, as an infiltrator, to get in some way into human society, which had been done before, by posing as a kind of idiot or something like that, for he wouldn't be noticed. At other times, of history, creatures like this weren't particularly remarked upon. But when a sensation arose about him, and he began to be investigated very closely, I think there was some fear that the thing had gone completely wrong, and that suspicions of his origin might be awakened. In fact, Fellbach's suspicion was maybe close to truth. And so it's decided that that the experiment had to be terminated and the creature killed. And this was done. A very remarkable thing about the story is most people connected with him, his tutors and people who studied him, all died very shortly afterwards. Now, Kestenhaus is not the, by any means, the first such creatures. All through history there's accounts of odd creatures turning up. Very often, of course, they come into a society, close society, frightened of strangers, frightened of monsters, who quietly kill them. This happened during the Napoleonic Wars in Derbyshire. An odd monster turned up and was tried and condemned to death and executed before anyone could speak to us very much about it. And then there was the green children of Woolpate in Suffolk, who appeared sometime during the 12th century. And they were very much like Caspar Hauser. They were particularly sort of numb. They didn't know where they'd come from. They were green in colour. The extraordinary about Caspar Hauser was he didn't really appear at first like a human being. He had very odd features. And he had certain deformities about him. But in the course of time, very quickly, he adapted himself, or he was adopted, and these odd features disappeared. The same happened with these green children at Woolpit. They lost their green colour. And although the little boy died, there's two of them, little boy and little girl. Little girl was about 16, I think, same age as Caspar Hauser. Little girl survived and became an ordinary human being. In fact, married a local man. And now, if you want to see what sort of people these extraterrestrial infiltrators may be, we can possibly get some clue by the study of prehistory, mythology, and certain old aspects of folklore. Now, interpreting mythology is never easy. It can be used to support almost any kind of theory, and a great deal of misguided attempts have been made to see all stories of mythology in terms of early flying saucers. Yet one aspect of mythology is very striking, which is that the same stories occur all over the world, in all continents, unmistakably deriving from the same source, since some of the details and the names involved could not have occurred in widely separated places entirely by chance. This must lead us to suppose that at least the basic shape of universal mythology does derive from some sort of memory of another era of great changes, another period like the one we're possibly now entering, where the whole shape of human history underwent an upheaval. What happened then is what we must possibly shortly expect to happen again, in a slightly different form. A race of highly advanced beings came to Earth in circular spacecraft, and these craft are clearly described in stories and pictures from early mythology. They found the human race in a complete state of nature, unable to take even the first step towards civilization. And the reason for this was that the concept of civilization, of living in any other way than that of animals, had no place in the boundaries of people's thought at the time. Just that we weren't yet able to open our minds to expanded ideas, to a higher system of thought, which we must possibly soon face. The reason why the human race went on so long without even the first steps in civilization being taken was that the atmosphere of thought was not there to enable them to do so. Now, when these superior people from the sky came to Earth, man for the first time realized saw the possibility, was faced with the necessity for mental expansion. These creatures so shocked the people at the time that a new kind of thought, as we might soon expect now, had to come into being. The gods, as we call them, appear to have acted to an extraordinary extent like the 19th century colonializing power. They introduced certain men to their way of life, Scoble had to manage the first few elements of civilization, the use and control of fire, primitive agriculture, including the use of wheat, and wheat appears not to be a natural growth on Earth, and flight. Now, how much the civilizing mission was deliberate is hard to say. Maybe like 19th century colonialists, the gods had no particular policy towards the natives. Perhaps the use of fire and other things that they introduced was given to man by mistake, or by some sympathetic god, some early liberal, as appears to be the case of Prometheus. Whatever the cause, it appears that eventually there was war, trouble between the gods and the natives. Again, as in anti-colonial wars, the gods were not exactly defeated. They could have wiped out the natives, and in fact it looks as if this was almost done. But for some reason, they decided to withdraw, or not to appear openly. They left behind them a post-colonial society. Some men had very advanced knowledge of technology, and for a short time, a culture like that of Britain just after the withdrawal of the Romans was able to flourish. But since the tendency of all civilizations imparted from somewhere else, which had natural growth, is to decline, the underlying culture on which it feeds is lacking. The post-invasion civilized communities on Earth soon collapsed. In some cases, useful knowledge survived, embedded in tribal law and taboos. Some remains of advanced technology also survived. In India and China, for example, where the tradition of the departed gods remained strongest, the knowledge of flight never quite died out. Throughout the early history of India and China, and possibly other countries from early civilization, there is to be found descriptions of flying machines based on those that gods used. They were, however, few and never put to any real use, because the culture of the time was not really suitable for any use to be found for the art of flying. And in China, their manufacture was forbidden by an emperor, who said that the widespread use of flight would mean that castles and cities were vulnerable from the air. And in India, a man who made a flying machine, quoting the old story, was asked to make leather for the king, and he said, no, the only point of these things is to keep them unusual, to keep them exclusive. If everybody could fly, it would be more fun to me. This really was a level in which flight persisted as a kind of toy. Later on, of course, the Christian church suppressed all references to flight, either past or present. The church was concerned to stamp out all memory of pre-Christian religions, which were based on the tradition of the old flying gods. What is interesting is that nearly all later attempts to fly in medieval times and such were undertaken by monks or priests, the only people who had access to old documents describing flight in the past. In this way, it may be said that the tradition of flight inherited from the gods never actually died, and in fact was behind our present ability to make flying machines. Now, the gods left Earth in their secular flying machines, and these can be clearly seen and drawn in early rock carvings and documents. The gods of India and Assyria, none of eastern countries, those to whom a tradition of flight attaches, are shown flying in the sky inside a circular vehicle emerging from a kind of wheel. And this vehicle is also a vehicle of destruction. During the rebellion of men against the gods in Egypt, the story comes from, the supreme god Ra sent some of his people to attack the rebellious men in a great disc, which slaughtered a great number of them. In fact, nearly all of them, and they slaughtered and stopped just in time to preserve a few. This is one of the kind of flood myths which occur in all civilizations. This disc is seen depicted in Egyptian monuments quite frequently, the disc with wings, disc in the sky, and the legend of it is also survived. Now, this kind of review of mythology had to be very general, and it's not particularly original. It is, however, a necessary background to study of the persistence of a belief in flying saucers in very early times. There's one essential key to the study, that is, that the figure of the serpent, or the raven, or the dragon, or worm, they're the same thing, almost always stands for the flying saucer, the circular vehicle by which the gods came down to earth. This can be seen perhaps as purest form in the legend of the Ainus, the aborigines of Japan, which describes the introduction of fire. According to this legend, the goddess of fire was sent down to earth on some mission, and the serpent, who was in love with her, asked if he could accompany her. She did, and he took her down to earth. He coiled himself up into a circle with the tail of his mouth, and they flew down to earth. They landed so hard, according to the legend, that they made a kind of pit on the ground, and other dragons, other serpents came down too, and they also made pits. And it's interesting, I think, to wonder whether this pits of this type, which the Ainus still know about, they still know where they are, and they look upon them as some kind of veneration, if there's any connection between this kind of pit in the ground made by, allegedly by a vehicle from the sky, and the Charlton crater, which you remember some years ago, appeared in Wiltshire. It seems possible that not only in Japan among these people, but in other places, the small pit in the ground had some kind of meaning to earlier people. In Scotland, a number of stone circles have in the centre of them a kind of depression, a kind of pit, which archaeologists think has some kind of religious significance. I think it's quite possible that a number of stone circles, which appear to be placed in a fairly arbitrary fashion, some of them, do in fact enclose a spot where a sky vessel has landed. And to the serpent, because another example of the coiled-up serpent comes from Ireland in the serpents which St. Patrick rejected from Kilpatrick, the whole legend of County Mayo, and they also were curled up. And recently someone discovered that Irish people have believed that snakes move by coiling themselves up into a circle and building along like hoops to the air. All gods in mythology to whom a legend of flight attaches are shown accompanied by a serpent. As many examples, Medea, Artemis, Ptolemaeus, pulled to the air by chariots drawn by serpents. And the winged disc of Egypt, the disc of Horus, is also, there's two serpents on each side of it. But over this flight in mythology, the serpent is always there. This is, I think, almost that exception. The serpent is known as this kind of code for the space vehicle, the circular space vehicle, the serpent or the dragon. The serpent is also, by transference, identified with the superior race, the gods themselves. The serpents impart all god knowledge. And in some story, they're responsible for the introduction of nearly all knowledge and technology on which civilization is founded. Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine, was taught by a centaur or a serpent, and the serpent ground his staff. In Babylonian tradition, the serpent introduced agriculture and other advanced knowledge. And it seems that the serpent from the sky is thought of as being a kind of founder of civilization, has introduced ideas which didn't develop naturally, that were introduced from somewhere else. And of course, in the Garden of Eden myth, the serpent first set men along the path of civilization, a step which caused the first misery and a great upheaval, such as we may possibly soon have to face. The serpent is also the guardian of precious things, jewels, riches, beautiful women, and objects which confer special qualities like longevity or wisdom. And these benefits can only be acquired by the slaying or appeasing of the serpent or dragon, who guards them. Legends of this being done by human heroes like Hercules, when he stole the apples of the Hesperides, he had to kill the dragon, which guarded. And in this way, the belief that the serpent guarded the gifts which the gods had, but which man wasn't allowed to have, led to a kind of cargo cult. There's the second being led to a kind of cargo cult, such as appears today among the natives of New Guinea and other islands in the South Seas. The natives have seen when they're settled in this cargo cult, natives have seen the possessions of the Europeans, and they associate them with the airplanes they see flying overhead. If only they think they could attract these vehicles to come and land among them, they could plunder them of their rich cargo. They therefore try by sympathetic magic to attract them down. This is much the same belief as is behind legends of dragon and serpent slaying. The dragon or serpent is the rich burden of the gods, the disc in the sky full of the gods' possessions. And if it could be killed, you won't want to find it and kill it. One would be able to take possession of the various benefits which the gods alone enjoyed. Now, a further appearance of a dragon or serpent in this connection is in the story of the sacrifice to it of young men and girls. The Manitou was, of course, an example. Behind this story is a practice which was kept up long after the gods departed from living on Earth. This was a practice of offering specimens of men and animals on high places to the gods who still landed there to pick them up. The reason they wanted them, and the number of abductions and attempted abductions which go on today, according to reports, suggested they still had the same idea, was to study and experiment. Now, one form of experiment is illustrated in a belief in what happens to people abducted by extraterrestrial beings, a belief which occurs in its purest form in a story, a popular story from Welsh folklore, which describes how two men are going for a walk in the country and they come across a circle on the ground, a fairy ring or something like that, and one of the men steps inside it and he's immediately whirled away and not seen again. Now, the next thing that happens is that some 60 or 100 years later, a long time later, the same man appears again, and he thinks he's only been away a few minutes. And he goes back to his farm, finds all the people there, who are they, and they explain that they're the owners. And they then recognize him as great-grandfather, something he left a long time ago. And interestingly, when they recognize who he is, they give him something to eat. And always, when he has something to eat, he dies immediately. Or in some stories, as soon as he touches earth, he dies immediately. This is, I believe, an illustration of a belief that experiments have happened for keeping people alive in space so that they can be returned to earth, apparently as ordinary human beings, but directed by some extraterrestrial force, in fact as zombies. It may well be that the experiment has recently been successful, and there are people from the past now on Earth who are not, as it were, in control of themselves. Another reason for kidnapping men is for experimental breeding. Now, you know the recent incident which Mr. Crichton described in the Crime Fossil Review of the Brazilian farmer who was flying when an object from the sky, a flying saucer, landed beside him, and he was pulled into it, and his clothes were taken off, he's put on a bed, and he was seduced by some woman inside the flying saucer, and then he was, in a very scientific way, and then he was ejected. Well, this story is somehow reflected in what's happened in the past. There's a whole body of folklore dealing with erotic relations between men and extraterrestrials, sometimes involving the sky vehicle, the flying saucer. An Indian legend, Red Indian, Algonquin Indian legend, describes how a hunter found a peculiar circle on the ground. It was as if a beaten track going round in a circle, something wore away the grass, but there's no path leading to it. He couldn't explain it, so he hid in some bushes. And a circular vehicle from the sky came down, a kind of basket is described, with seven beautiful girls in it. And they landed absolutely in the ring. And the girls got out and began to
vase or dart or something. And he rushed out and grabbed one, and the rest of them rushed into the basket and flew away. And he tripped her the way he caught and took her home and lived with her for 2 or 3 years. He had a child with her. And was quite happy, very happy. One day, she wanted to return where she came from, so she made a basket, a kind of circular circle again, like the one she'd come in. And she sat in the basket and sang a certain song, the kind of song which induced levitation. And this is quite a common idea among several groups of people, that sound can induce levitation, that things can be made to fly through the air by the right note and such. It occurs in several different continents, in folklore of several different countries. Theosophists have very much supported. Anyway, she escaped, and her husband was very sad. But some years later, she came back. She took the baby with her, by the way. And she took the husband with her too, and they all went up to the sky. Before they left, she said to the husband, bring specimens of every kind of animal which you can shoot to go up to the sky with us, which he did, and they all ascended in the basket. Now, to get back to the serpent and human sacrifice in high places, it's very interesting that Dr. Stukeley, the 17th century archaeologist, recognized in several of the stone circle monuments of Britain temples devoted to the worship of the specimen from the sky. It's called them Dracontia. Now, poor Dr. Stukeley was one of the earliest archaeologists, and his later conclusions were, he was very excited by this idea of the serpent from the sky. I didn't quite know what he made of it. His work later was very difficult to get. Well, what's interesting is that it's been almost entirely, it's been a kind of conspiracy to suppress it. Professor Piggott, an archaeologist, wrote a book about Stukeley some time ago, which he entirely failed to mention anything about his later conclusions. People say he was, like I say about Jung in his later years, he was old and mad and he went wrong towards the end. But I think that his idea of the of many of the prehistoric monuments of Britain being serpent temples is extraordinarily right, and I think archaeologists are now beginning to come around to thinking this may be so. In fact, it's very odd if it wasn't, because everywhere the serpent, there's this worship of the serpent, and in Britain that there must have been too. Now, these stone circles, which he called Dracontia, are nearly all beside some hill or mound, at the top of which, I believe, after consecration of a stone temple, the people who were going to be sacrificed were taken up the top of the hill to be offered to the sky gods, descending in their secular serpentine vehicles. Where there was no natural hill, an artificial one was built. One such is Silbury Mound, near Avery, the stone circle of Avery, which was stupidly believed to be a serpent temple. Silbury Hill is not a burial place, apparently. It's just an artificial mound, the biggest in Europe. No one's ever known its purpose. But I think it's certainly connected with Avery. I think it is the mound on which the people who were to be offered, the beautiful men and girls who were to be offered to the sky gods, were put to be taken up. Other places like this are Croagh-Patrick, the sacred mountain of Ireland in County Mayo, where St. Patrick ejected the serpents. And at the foot of Croagh-Patrick was also a stone circle with a path leading up to it. I think this was used for the same purpose. Also, probably Worm Hill on Wearside, near Durham, where the Lambton Worm appeared. The Lambton Worm, according to a story, curled itself round the top of the hill in a coil and demanded offerings from the local villagers. It was killed by a local hero. He used to wind himself around people, and he dressed himself up in a suit made of razor blades, and then the worm coiled himself around him, and all cut to pieces, swept down the river. Now, the most remarkable of all these temples, which Stukeley calls Dracontia, is Callanish in the Outer Hebrides, the island of Lewis. But at Callanish, there's no mound where the sacrifice might have taken place. But think there is a connection, a pretty certain connection here, to the west of Callanish. There's a group of islands called the Fennel Islands. They're right out in the Atlantic, some way west of Lewis, and uninhabited. I think always will have been in recent times. But there's very odd legends attaching to these islands. Until recently, people of Lewis used to go there to pasture their sheep and to collect birds' eggs. And when they did so, they had to observe certain ceremonies. They had to approach them a certain way, very deferentially, and they had to speak. They actually had to speak a different language. They weren't allowed to speak Gaelic. They had to speak certain different words. Some of them being preserved. They're quite unlike any other language. But when they went to Fanlands, they had to speak this language, no other. And the tradition was that the islands were inhabited by little men, by dwarfs. And I think that possibly this was the island which the victims, or people who were to sacrifice to the gods, were taken to be given to the little men as a kind of offering which the gods wanted. Now, extraordinary thing happened in 1901. The government built a lighthouse on these islands, and they put four lighthouse keepers to guard it. Three always on duty and one on leave. About a year after it was built, the man on leave came back with the ship to relieve one of the other three men. And there was no sign of life at all on the island. All three other lighthouse keepers had disappeared. This is a classical mystery like the Mary Celeste. And all the patronus details of that, breakfast, cooking, and all the everything order, the logbook kept up. And just absolutely no sign of the man at all. Whether the tradition of, is a mistake, or a tradition of sacrifice was thought by some other creatures to be being kept up, these men were offered, I don't know. What is significant is that the lighthouse is, of course, a tower. And towers were built very often, I think, instead of mounds for sacrifice. Now, our heroes in mythology do not have natural ends. They die by getting up to a high place and, as it were, sacrificing themselves. Oedipus and Hercules and many others, examples of this, they don't actually die, but they're sort of taken away. An English hero, Robin Hood, is somewhat like this. He died, as far as we can see, rather mysteriously, on the top of a tower. And I think it's possibly a memory of the same kind of sacrifice of a hero. Now, one of the most extraordinary sights connected with the dragon, the serpent, is White Horse Hill in Berkshire. And just below there, there's a hill called Dragon Hill. There's a spot where, not uncommon tradition, that no grass ever grows since St. George killed the dragon there. Dragon Hill, as he lies below the White Horse. And it's very extraordinary. It's a very haunted place. People have always been very frightened of it. And also, near the White Horse, is this cave, this original barrow. The Earthstone is now a cave called Wayland Smith's Cave. Now, Wayland Smith was the smith of the gods. And the thing was that if you left your horse outside his cave, he'd left a sixpence on the stone, he'd chew it for you. But what's interesting about him is he's one of the gods, he's one of the few people in later Norse mythology who would say that he could fly. When he was captured by some king, he and his brother manufactured artificial wings and escaped. I think that also, you see, near Wayland Smith's Cave, near the White Horse, near Dragon Hill, on top of the whole crest is Uffington Castle. I think this was a sacrifice place where the gains a circular earthwork. I think this was a place where extraterrestrials came down, picked up who they wanted, who was left them there, and went away. I think Uffington Church in the valley below is probably the site of a stone circle where the service before was held. And then, of course, the biggest evidence of all is the White Horse. Now, the White Horse carved in the chalk is extraordinary. It can't really be seen from the ground. It's obviously meant to be seen from the air. There's no doubt about this. There's no place on the ground which it can be properly seen. It's just hard to know how it was even laid out. And there are several monuments in Britain and elsewhere like this. Stonehenge is according to someone called Dr. Weaver, who's Dean of Boston University School of Public Communications. Dr. Weaver said that Stonehenge only makes sense if it's seen from the air. Also significant about Stonehenge is just near Stonehenge is this great earthwork called the Cursus, which is a kind of sausage-shaped earthwork about 2 miles long. And the two of the Stonehenge and the Cursus seem to me to make, to form on the ground the two shape of objects commonly seen in the sky, the circle and the cigar shape. And I think it's possible this again is a kind of cargo cult monument, that gods were supposed to be attracted by these shapes being produced on the ground and to come down and land there. The most remarkable, of course, of all these things can only be seen from the air, which is, I suppose, a sign to the people in India, are on the Nazca Plains of Peru, where they weren't discovered until airplane travel came in. And when they were discovered, people had hardly believe it, because for hundreds of many, many miles, these great figures are carved onto the on the ground. They cannot be seen from the ground at all. They can only be seen from the air, animals and figures and such. The Aborigines of Australia also carve things flat on the ground, so they can again only be seen from the sky, but not to any great extent. Australia, you see, is unique in many ways. It's also unique in that among Aborigines there, there's an actual living tradition of visitors from the sky who came in the past. They look on them as the ancestors of their race, the creators of their society who came down from the sky and then vanished. There are even portraits of these creatures. Now, Mr. Crichton also did an article about claims that pictures of spacemen have been found on caves, and quite rightly he said that most of it's rubbish. But in this case there is a tradition that they are in fact spacemen, and they occur in the Kimberley Mountains and rock shelters and caves. And they show what the Aborigines call the Wangina, the past race of creators. They're white-faced with dark staring eyes and black noses and no mouths. Over their heads is an inverted horseshoe which looks like a sort of helmet. The impression they give is of people wearing old-fashioned gas masks. And they have, of course, been dismissed as mythical figures. Yet the odd thing is that the Aborigines of the area where they are found are very talented and entirely naturalistic painters. They only paint what they see. The other figures on the walls are, for instance, of early colonial types, of Dutchmen and clogs and Japanese sailors and policemen. In all cases, the Aborigines know what the paintings represent. And they also know what the Wangina represent. They say they are men from the sky, and they came down and they painted them. They keep their portraits still repainted up to now. Henri Lhote's French expedition to Sahara, which found these extraordinary rock paintings of great helmeted figures, which they call Martians, because they look so much like Martians in science fiction pictures. There, of course, is no tradition to explain what they meant. Yet the Aborigines say that they have a tradition. They say these figures, which they have on their rocks, are spacemen. And what is significant is they appear with a figure of a serpent beside them, which I think is added indication that these figures are thought of as coming down from the sky in the form of a serpent. Australia is, of course, a great country for flying saucer sightings, and always has been in the diaries of Burke and Wills, explorers, as an account of a flying saucer. And recently, of course, there's been these landing places in Queensland. It's interesting that there's a connection between the flying saucers seen today and the Aborigines who see them say that they're of course containing these creatures that they have painted on the walls of their ancestors, and they think they're quite a natural phenomenon. Thank you very much.